All right, well, I think we've got a full house, so let's go ahead and get started. Welcome. I feel bad following our last keynote because I don't have any funny pictures to show right off the bat. So, but we'll get through this. So my name's Aaron Bjork, and first of all, I'd sort of welcome you to the Seattle area. I'm one of the few guys that, I know you guys are from all around the world, but I'm one of the few guys that work here at Microsoft that's actually from the Seattle area. So I was born and raised. We're up here in Redmond, and I live down here in Maple Valley. So this is home. So this weather you see, this is what we deal with all year round. So, but welcome. I hope you had a good trip, and hope you're really enjoying the summit. Our topic today is unmanaging agile teams, and I hope you sort of caught on to the title that I think there's sort of a play on words here that we need to think about when we think about, as leaders, how we interact with and build environments for our teams. So before we kind of jump into that, I want to give you a little bit of sort of who I am. Again, I'm a Seattle native. I'm a married guy, three kids. Who's got more than three kids? I always ask this. Okay, look around. Those are the guys you need to buy a drink tonight for. So they're working harder than the rest of us. I've got two dogs. We have whippets at our house. Does anybody have a whippet? Anybody? Yeah, whippet. We got a whippet? Yeah? A couple here. So whippets are like greyhounds, but about half the size, really fast. So love our dogs. I was a University of Washington grad, so I went to school here in the area, and I was a business major, so I didn't study computer science in school, but sort of fell in love with programming afterwards. I'm an avid golfer. How many golfers we got? Oh, that's more than normal. So I always share with people, it's my biggest regret is I joined an industry where nobody plays golf for work. I even asked Brian Harry last night, I said, have you ever been invited to play golf for work? And he said, I haven't. But he was happy about that because I don't think he plays golf very much. And then finally, gone rural. This last 3 months, or 3 months ago, my wife and I bought a new place down in Maple Valley, and we live on acreage. So we're kind of figuring out what it's like to own a barn and buy a tractor and things like that. So we've got all kinds of new adventures. And then I suffer from back pain. Yeah, there's a lot of that in the room, I'm sure, as well. So you can see my Twitter handle there. I don't tweet a lot, but you can follow me there. And I'd love to hear feedback from you. So that's my email address. Feel free to shoot me an email. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the presentation, struggles that you're having with your own agile teams and whatnot. So feel free to reach out to me. Okay, the agenda that I've built for us today is sort of three parts. We're going to talk first about how we really unmanage agile teams and what that looks like. Second, I want to share with you how we here at Microsoft are unmanaging our own agile teams. I think Brian yesterday in his keynote shared a little bit about how we run our process, and I want to give you a little more detail. I want to actually show you some of the ways we're doing it and what's worked and what hasn't. And then at the end, I'm going to maybe just give a little bit of a demo on some of the ways I think TFS can help. I'm a program manager and I work on TFS, so I want to share with you just a few of those new things that we've added that I think contribute to this conversation. So that's our agenda for the talk. Okay, so how do you unmanage agile teams? Well, I think before we get there, you have to kind of step back and say, why are we all trying to do this agile thing in the first place? What's really so special about it? And I love this quote from the guys at Forrester. Dave West is actually here, if you haven't bumped into him. But it talks about how essentially, the world is just a different place than it used to be. If I think back to 10 years ago when I bought a piece of software, I might drive down to the big box store and you would look for that piece of software on the shelf and you'd flip it over to the sidebar and you'd check the RAM requirements and memory and, you know, do I have a fast enough CPU to run this thing? Then you'd take it home and you'd install it and you might read the manual actually to figure out how to use it and you'd play with it for a while. It was a big commitment. And in today's world, we're buying software all the time. I mean, if I asked you all right now to go buy a piece of software without even moving, if you already have your phone out or if you're on your laptop, you could buy a piece of software within a matter of seconds, really. And we're making those transactions all the time. And there's two sort of impacts to that. One is that the barriers to entry into the software world are just much lower than they've ever been. You've got all kinds of channels where you can deliver software, deliver value, deliver product to customers. So those barriers are way, way down, and a lot more people are playing in that space. And because of that, these market opportunities come and go very, very quickly. And I was talking with, I think, some folks in the room here yesterday about, you know, why are you guys trying to do Agile? What's, you know, what are you guys really struggling with? And they articulated this. They said, in our industry, the market opportunities are just coming and going much, much quicker. And we've got to be set up to react to that. So I think that's why we're all trying to sort of do Agile. You know, I love that statement and that quote. But then we have to sort of talk about managing. So what does it mean to manage an Agile team? And I looked up the definition of manage for this talk. And, you know, there's a lot of definitions on the web. But I picked this one because it was kind of fun. Discipline or control person or animal. And I think sometimes we think about our jobs as leaders in an organization is that we're supposed to do this. We're supposed to keep control of our teams or our animals. And we almost treat our teams like this in a lot of ways. We set up structures and environments that make them feel like this. They're not a part of the conversation. They listen to us, and we tell them how to do the conversation. And I think we've got that backwards. So kind of starting out, I want to take a step back from managing and say, what does it really mean to then unmanage? If we are managers, I'm assuming, raise your hand if you're a manager of some sort. Yeah, look around the room. Everybody in this room is a manager in some way, shape, or form. And so the art for us is to figure out, how do we do this well? And how do we not overmanage, micromanage, and really get in the way of our teams, but how do we unmanage that? So that's what we're going to walk through. So to me, unmanaging speaks to two words. And it speaks to control and environment. And you can see that I think traditionally, managing is about control. It's big. And I think we need to flip this around. So the first thing I want to talk to you about is, what do your environments look like for your teams? I actually don't mean, what does the environment look like for you? I mean, what does the environment look like for your teams? The folks with their hands on the keyboard, writing code, making decisions every day about your product, what does their environment look like? So let's kind of jump into that a little bit. Who's ever heard of the pit of success? Or this kind of, yeah. Somebody mentioned it yesterday in a talk. And I think, I'm not sure who really came up with this. I first heard it from Brad Abrams a few years ago. And he talked about that we want our software, when customers interact with our software, we want it to feel like they're falling into the pit of success. And it speaks to, you know, usability and how easy to use your software is. If you have to read a manual, that's not falling into the pit of success. The iPhone was the pit of success. People picked it up, they immediately knew what to do with it, and they got value out of it. They had a lot of fun with it. So that's called the pit of success. And for our software teams, I think we want to build that same environment. We want to make a place where our teams, if you will, are falling into that pit of success. It should be a place where people want to come work, where they have fun every day, where they're really successful without even trying, and where the things that we're setting up as managers aren't getting in the way of that and aren't prohibiting that. So you want to create this. So let's take a look at what that environment looks like. How many of you guys have ever planted a garden? A few of you. Okay, so I planted a garden a few years back. And, you know, we built raised beds in our backyard. And we, you know, brought in really great topsoil. And we created this really, really great environment for our vegetables. And we had, you know, big dreams of what we'd grow. And, you know, we did pretty well, actually. I don't know if you've ever thrown a zucchini seed in the ground, but you'll have more zucchinis coming out of your ears than you know what to do with. Try it if you want to feel really good about your gardening skills. I learned one lesson, which is that you shouldn't build raised garden beds out of treated lumber. Treated lumber has arsenic in it, and arsenic and food don't mix well. So I actually built these things, and then my neighbor said, "What are you going to plant in those?" And, you know, long story short, I built them again the next weekend. So lesson learned. But if you think about environments, I could take a set of seeds and scatter them around in my backyard. And if you were a seed, which of these two environments would you want to be planted in? The seed will likely grow in both environments. Seeds are pretty good. They need a little bit of water. They need a little bit of sun. And you'll get something out of them. But I guarantee you the seeds planted in this environment on this side are going to have a healthier crop. They're going to produce more fruit, more value, if you will. and they're going to be happier plants in the long run. I see a lot of those kind of environments that we build for our teams. And what I mean by that is we even come as leaders to conferences like this, and we learn about it, and we hear words like value and lean and scrum, and we can say it and we can do it. And then we go back and we set up environments that look like that, where they're not well cared for, where the seeds being planted in those environments are unhealthy, and they're not much fun to be a part of. So I think the challenge for us is to figure out how do we create environments that look more like this. And I just grabbed this picture off the web, but that looks, if I was a seed, that looks like a garden I'd want to be planted in. Okay, so again, as managers in your organizations, let's talk about which environment we should be paying attention to here. And I drew this pyramid to sort of articulate your organizational chart. And what I see happen a lot is we spend a lot of time focused on this environment. We want to make sure that we as managers have all the right information. I need all this data to make sure my teams are doing their job. Typically, I don't go ask them how they're doing, but I need all this data that tells me how they're doing, and we get it a little bit backwards. My challenge to you is let's start focusing on these environments down here, where the folks in our teams actually work. And again, what does that environment look like? Now, I'll be honest with you and say that I think you can apply a fair amount of science to these environments for teams. I think in our last talk, we talked a little bit about, you know, build, measure, learn, and things like that. Build, measure, learn is essentially taking some concepts and building a science out of it, that a pattern that we can follow. It makes a lot of sense. And I do think we can apply a lot of that science. I think Scrum is, in a sense, a science. It's a great pattern for how to run teams. It works really well. We can apply that at this bottom level. Now, at this top level, becomes a little bit more of a challenge. And I think you guys in this room exist in that sort of middle level or somewhere. I don't know, maybe some of you are at the top, literally. But it becomes a bit more of an art form here at this level for a couple of reasons. One is that most people that are higher up in the org chart have gotten there because they've got a big personality, usually. They're really, really good at what they've done. And they've got a set of patterns that they've followed that have served them well. So we deal with this around here in Microsoft. If you look around our company, our leadership team is made up of, and I'm really generalizing, but really made up of folks that have built their careers on shipping box product, right? We ship a box piece of software that we then deliver to a customer on maybe a two-year cadence. And I'm sure all of you are well aware that that environment, that world is changing very, very fast. You know, you heard Brian in his keynote yesterday talk about all the changes we've made in our organization. And I think we have to, as we want to change the environments down at the bottom, we have to be really careful about how we influence and manage those above us. And we have to think of it as more of an art form. I know a lot of us, I was talking to somebody yesterday and they said, well, we have all these great ideas that we want to do down here, but the people in the middle just keep saying no. And I said, well, hey, I'm a tools guy. Like, I don't have tools that will solve that problem. That's a people problem. And you've got to figure out how you're going to influence them. So as you're building these environments, I want you to think, too, about how you influence up. You got to have direct conversations. You've got to be real. You've got to build that that trust and transparency. And I'll talk a little bit more about how we're doing that. Okay, so I want to outline three things that I think make a great environment. And the three things that we're going to talk about are, first, motivation. Two, what are the objects, or the object, the rules, and the score. And then third is religious freedom. So let's talk about motivation. I talk about this book a lot, and I'm going to continue talking about it because it really is a fabulous book. How many of you have read Drive? Okay, there's maybe 10%. I'm just going to say, if you do anything when you leave this conference, pick up this book and read it. Don't listen to what I'm saying. Listen to what Dan Pink said, because Pink outlines in his book Drive The subtitle is The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us. And he contrasts two different styles of motivation. He says that we can use traditional methods of motivation, which he characterizes as carrots and sticks. So we can use the carrot, which is sort of reward people, you know, dangle it out in front of them. I'm going to give you more money if you work harder. I'm going to give you rewards, more titles. And that will motivate people to some extent. Or you can use a stick approach, which is if you don't do what I say, I'm going to punish you. You know, I'm going to hit you with the stick, to put it bluntly. And you can get results out of people by using that method as well. But he said if you really want to tap into people and what makes them go, you're going to give them three things. You're going to give them autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And you're going to create, if you will, environments where your teams and individuals have those three things. So let's take a look at what each of those three things are. Autonomy is pretty simple. It's that simple urge to direct our own lives. You need to make decisions for yourself. You know, if you kind of step back and you think about your teams, do your teams have autonomy on their backlogs? You know, do they even own their own backlogs, or do you give them their backlogs? And think about that. The team is the one building the software. They're the one doing the majority of the learning as they're putting it together. But do they have the autonomy to actually make changes to the design or to the requirements or what you're putting together? I think we've got to give our teams autonomy. Whoops. The second is mastery. So this is sort of that expert skill, if you will, and the desire to get really, really good at something. I mentioned earlier that I'm a golfer, and I'm an avid golfer. I played golf most of my life, but I didn't really play golf until about 7 years ago. And it's when I realized that golf is not a physical game, but it's a mental game. And it's a game of sort of fighting yourself for 5 hours out there to keep making good decisions and hang in there and see if you can make it to the end. And it's very rewarding when it pays off. But that process of trying to get better and practicing and failing, actually, and failing, but going back and hitting more balls and changing your grip and buying a new set of clubs now and then. And doing all that process of improvement is sort of innate to human nature. We all have that in us, and we all want to be really, really good at something. And I'll tell you that the folks on your teams are software developers because they love being software developers. They want to be masters at this. Now, I know they're getting a paycheck. I know that. I understand that's a part of it. But they chose software development because it's something they love to do. And we've got to give them an environment where they can fall in love with it. So a couple things that I always point out here are, do you build teams or do you build fractions of teams? What I mean by that is, are the members of your teams a member of a single team and really a member of that team? Or do you ask them to say, well, I want you to spend 20% of your time here and half your time here and the other 30% over here on three different projects with three different groups? We always talk about Peter Provost, a good friend of mine. He always says, there's no such thing as half of a person. It just doesn't exist. And when we do that to our teams, when we do that to the individuals on our teams, we're not letting them become masters. We're randomizing them and creating problems for them. The other thing is how the unit of team, how do you let that unit grow and work together? Somebody asked me yesterday, with your teams, how often do you change your teams? And I said, well, we usually change them every time we reorg, which can be more often than sometimes we want. But it's typically about 2 years. We leave teams together for 2 years. And I'm going to talk more about what that means. But that means that a group of people are working tightly together for a long period of time. It's not every sprint we're creating a new set of teams and putting them together. And I think as a team, there's a lot of, you know, people dynamics that go into that. You've got to create an environment where your teams can become masters, where they can build on those relationships with one another and learn to work together. And the final one here is purpose. Purpose is probably the most important because purpose speaks to the reason why we're doing something. And I challenge you to go back when you get back to your offices tomorrow or Monday or whenever you're flying back. And just grab a couple people and say, do you know why you're building the features that you're building? Grab a couple people on the team and see what their answer is. And my guess is that a lot of them don't. They don't really understand why. They're not sure really how they fit into that picture. And you've got to find a way to bring them closer and connect them, if you will, to your customers. Make sure they understand why the software they're building is important. It's critical. So these are some of the just key words from the Agile Manifesto that I pulled out. You know, individuals and interactions over processes and tools, working software, customer collab, responding to change. And I think that these three words, autonomy, mastery, and purpose, have a lot of overlap with those principles. And when I read Drive for the first time, and I've probably read it two or three times now, it's just one of those books you kind of can keep going back to. First time, I'll tell you a quick story. The first time I read it, I remember being lying in bed at night and reading it. And I kept stopping, and I would tell my wife, I'd say, you got to listen to this. And I, read her a paragraph or a page. And anyway, pattern repeated, and eventually she just stopped me and she said, okay, I'll read the book. do we have to do this every night? I'll read it, But it's one of those books that I use this stuff with my kids, with myself, with all interactions. And I think there's huge overlap here between the principles behind the Agile movement and behind autonomy, mastery, and purpose. We talk about teams, Agile is about building self-managed teams. That's what a lot of people say. And autonomy, mastery, and purpose speak to self-managed teams. So I want to tell a story that Pink tells and ask you which you would choose. So let me lay out an example here for you, or a scenario. Let's say you've got an organization that's setting out to build something. They've defined a place in the market that they say, we need to go fill that spot. We've got a plan. They build a business plan. They're very, very well funded, so limitless amounts of money. They're hiring the best people to go do it. They've, again, got this clear picture of what they want to go do and a plan for how they're going to go do it. So you've got that group on one side. On the other side, you've got a group of people that are going to build this thing in their spare time on weekends and evenings for free just because they want to, right? For no other reason. And, if I laid out those two scenarios for you, which would you choose? Well, my sense is if I really asked you and we were really honest with each other, we'd all choose the first one. That second one sounds scary. I don't really get that. It doesn't make a lot of sense. But let's take a look at the two groups in play here. And this is exactly what we saw with Encarta versus Wikipedia. Microsoft set out to build the greatest online encyclopedia known to man. It was well-funded. I said limitless amounts of money, but there's a lot of money in this company. We could throw a lot of money at that problem. Hiring the best and brightest people, pulled together some brilliant teams. Limitless resources. And on the flip side, you had this thing called Wikipedia, which grew out of people's love to contribute to something. They had autonomy in making decisions about what they wanted to work on. They could contribute where they were masters. They had domain knowledge and they could contribute. And they found purpose in it. And a lot of people say, well, what was their purpose? And I don't really know. The purpose was they were contributing to the greater good, but they saw purpose in what they were doing. And so we saw this thing called Wikipedia, which just explode out of nowhere. And I thought this was kind of funny, but here's Encarta, the definition of Encarta on Wikipedia, right? And I underlined a few words for you here, but Microsoft Encarta was, meaning it no longer exists. It's gone. Okay, and they discontinued it altogether back in 2009 because they couldn't compete against the environment that Wikipedia had created with autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Now, okay, I'm not asking you to go back to your teams and, throw out your plans and all that stuff. I'm not, I'm overgeneralizing here. But I think it's a great story that kind of tells us what we need to be paying attention to. And I think it's really, really relevant for our software teams. Okay, Let's move on next to three things that I call objects, rules, and the score. So if we were to sit down and play a board game together, you know, a couple of us in the front row here grab a board game and sit down. First thing you do when you get a board game is you flip over the box, and just on the inside cover on the back of the box, almost every board game is written down. Here's the object of the game, here's the rules of the game, and here's how you keep score. And you need to know those things if you're going to win the game or be successful at the game. These are three things that we need to give to our software teams as well, or our agile teams. We need to give them the object. What are they, again, this speaks to purpose, but what are they trying to do? What are they trying to accomplish? And again, I would challenge you to go back to your teams and ask them, do you understand the object of your team? What's your goal? What are you guys really, really going after? You know, what have we asked you to do? And what gap have we asked you to fill? And see if they have a good answer. My sense is a lot of them might not, but you got to make sure that you give this. Now, rules of the game, rules is kind of a, you know, it's one of those bad words. Like, it just sounds bad, rules. I use the word boundaries as a better example. But we've got to create boundaries for our team. And when, you know, boundaries and rules and whatnot, they're not designed to control, but they're designed to create that environment where we can run fast. I told this story last year at the ALM summit, but when we drive down 405 or I-5 or on a highway, we've got a set of rules that we all follow. There are lines painted on the road. There are rules that we all learned when we learned to drive, and we obey those. The rules are meant to keep us safe and allow us to go as fast as possible from point A to point B. And that's what those rules or boundaries are set up for. Once we know what those boundaries are, we can move fast down the freeway. Now, if there were no rules, you might think, well, we might be able to move faster. And the reality is you wouldn't be able to move faster. You'd slow down because it would turn into chaos. On the flip side, you could create a lot of rules, and we could put speed bumps, you know, every 100 yards, and we could create rules that you can only change lanes here and there, and pretty soon we would create gridlock in the other way. So there's a really fine balance here. The other thing is how are we keeping score? So what does success look like for your teams, and what things are you paying attention to? And I think this is another one of those areas where we get stuck a lot and we do way too much. So I'm going to move to my next slide, which I'm going to just introduce this warning to everybody, which says, you don't need this environment on the screen to keep score for your teams. Your teams don't need this environment. They need to know the basics. They need to know what you're paying attention to, and they need to know what they should be paying attention to. But you want to find just enough. You want to find that balance. And I'm a firm believer in less is more. Start with the minimum. You know, we talk about minimum viable product. You've heard a lot of that speak. Start it here as well. Make sure that when you think about the boundaries and scorekeeping for your teams, that you're starting with a less is more approach. Because you don't want your teams having to understand what goes on in a control room like this. It's a mess. Okay, so that was the second point. So we talked about motivation, we talked about the object, rules, and the score. Finally, this one might be a little more controversial, but I call this one religious freedom. And I guess I'll just make a statement that I think the methodology wars are sort of over. I don't care what methodology you use. I really don't. I care that you're finding ways to get the most value out of your teams and make them work. And I think at a conference like this, we're going to hear a whole bunch of patterns. We're going to hear people talk about Scrum. And hey, you do the Scrum way and, you know, you'll nail it every time. Build, measure, learn. Kanban, lean, you name it. They're all out there. And I'm going to tell you that they're all good. And that I think it's time we stopped worrying about which methodology we're following and start actually worrying about the environment for our teams. I've seen teams come in and, you know, or organizations come in and say, you know, well, we took Scrum training and we sent the whole organization to Scrum training and we're trying to tell them how to do it and we're trying to get them to do it and it's not working and, you know, and they get really frustrated. And I think that's often the wrong approach. I'm not against Scrum training. I'm not against Scrum. I I've written about Scrum. I love the Scrum principles and I love Scrum. But I think at times you've got to step back and say, you know, there are such things as square pegs and round holes. And there are even triangular pegs and oblong holes. And not every methodology or every practice is going to fit your environment. It might not fit your business. It might not fit the personalities on your team. But you can pull pieces from all of these things and make something that really works well for you. And Agile is all about that sort of, we talked earlier in the session before about that quick feedback. And it's about learning and adjusting and continuing that. So my sort of question to you is, or my statement to you is, you know, break away from being religious about this stuff and get into making sure that you're creating a healthy environment for your teams. Your teams don't care what religion they're following. They care about, you know, some of the other things that we've talked about, autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Okay, so so the final statement here is, do your teams exist in a healthy environment? And have you asked them if they do? So that's my challenge to you. Go back, grab a few folks from your teams and say, tell me about the environment. Do we have a healthy environment here for software developers? Or what's wrong? And I bet you they'll give you a pretty healthy list of things that you can do to improve. Okay, so I'm going to move on now and talk about how we at Microsoft, and specifically in TFS, have been trying to unmanage our own teams. So how are we doing this? And I'm going to tie a bunch of this back to some of what I've talked about earlier. I'm also going to be very transparent here and say that we are not perfect. I'm going to show you some examples of how screwed up we are, in fact. But this is something that we're working hard on, and it's important. I think you heard Brian talk about that yesterday, even in his talk, that we all recognize this from the top down. Okay, so I'm going to walk you through a few things. I'm going to talk to you about our roles, our organization, our teams, our cadence, our plan, and our practices, and some of the things that we do. Now, again, I'm not speaking for all of Microsoft. I'm speaking for our organization. This applies to about 400 people within the cloud services division. Okay, so first of all, our roles. We have three traditional roles at Microsoft: the program manager, the developer, and the QA. There are other roles, but those are the three basics and the three I'm going to focus on today. So I'm a program manager. My job is to make sure we're building the right thing. People often ask me, you know, what do you do? And I said, I listen to what customers want. I make sure we're building them what they need, you know, the whole wants and needs thing. And then I say I apologize for everything we're not doing, because that's the reality of it. Our backlogs are long. We're great at saying, yep, it's on the backlog, but you all know things can sit on the backlog for a long time. We have developers. They're responsible to ensure we're building products that are fast, reliable, and well-engineered. It's the basics. They're the ones putting this stuff together, okay? And then we have QA members, and they're making sure that they're high quality and that they meet customer needs. So from an organization standpoint, we're organized in what we call triads. So as a program manager, I report up to another program manager, Lori, and I'm going to break the model here. Lori actually reports to Brian. But throughout the company, PMs report up through PMs. Developers report up to developers. And QA members report up to QA members. At some point, they meet in the middle. But where they don't meet is at the team level or anything like that. So as a PM lead, I have 6 or 7 program managers that report to me. But I don't have developers reporting to me, and I don't have QA members. So that's our org chart. Okay, that's just how you manage the organization. Now, how does that look with regards to teams? So what we do is we take a program manager, okay, one, sometimes two program managers. Then we take a development lead and the people that report to that developer, development lead, and a QA lead, and the people that report to that QA lead, and those people together make a team, okay? And so a team looks sort of like this, and when you see dev and QA at the top, the dark boxes, those are leads. So that's where you see a little bit of the org chart actually match the team structure. So everybody on the team who's a developer reports to the same development lead who's on that team. But one development lead per team, one QA lead per team, and one, sometimes two PMs. The other thing that we do is we take our teams and we assign them scope, if you will, or an area of the product. And what we try to do is make sure those are vertical slices through the product and not horizontal slices. So we don't have a database team. We don't have a UI team. We don't have the business layer team, right? You have the work item tracking team, and they are building the DB aspects. They're building the UI. They're building the whole stack. They own that whole experience. And we do that for a couple of reasons. One is we want to make sure that there's sort of strong ownership from a scenario perspective. And we also want to make sure that we create as few dependencies between teams as possible. Now, dependencies exist. I'm not going to tell you they don't. They exist. But this is one way to sort of limit them. OK, so that's how our teams look. Within TFS, I think we have 9 teams. Within cloud services, I think we have in the neighborhood of 20. OK, gives you an idea of scale. OK, we operate on 3-week sprints. I think Dean, in his opening keynote, said, 3-week sprints are the worst. And I was like, oh, here we go. We do 3-week sprints. So week 1, week 2, week 3. Why 3 weeks? It's just worked for us. We tried 4 weeks, and it felt too long. We tried 2 weeks, and it felt too fast. So we settled on 3. Will we change it at some point? I think we will. We've got a goal to keep shrinking things down, keep doing more and more deployments. But right now, we're doing 3. And we've done 3 for about the last 2 years. So how is this different from the past? We started 3-week sprints when we started work on Team Foundation Server 2012. But in the 2008 product, we were operating on 10 to 12-week milestones. In 2010, we shortened that to 6 weeks, and now we're down to 3 weeks. That 3-week milestone, or 3-week sprint, includes, it's a traditional sprint. It includes coding, testing, validation, and there's a deployment aspect at the end. So we don't do like coding sprints, you know. We follow this. We're sort of Scrum, if you will, at the bottom level. We look the most like a Scrum organization. Now, when we used to do the 2008, these 10 to 12 weeks, we'd have this like 3-month period where we'd be coding like hell, right? And we'd declare victory at the end of it. We called it code complete. And people, you know, there was big emails that went out, and, you know, cake and beer or whatever. And what had we done? We had written a lot of code that had a lot of bugs in it. That's all we'd done. And now we entered stabilization phase, which you might have a, you know, 3-month coding period and then a 5-month stabilization phase. So it was more sort of traditional waterfall. But it created an environment where you couldn't react very quickly. So if you saw problems, or if you learned something new along the way, your opportunities to adjust your backlog or adjust what you're doing were very, very few. Now we get that opportunity every 3 weeks, which is great. These 3-week sprints overlap. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this. But do you see at the end here how we have this little light area? That's actually a 4th week. And I'm going to talk about what that 4th week is. So week 1, week 2, week 3, and the sprint ends. Okay, that is the end of the sprint. It really is. This 4th week, though, is where all those bits from all the different teams are the process of pushing them to production begins. And we have a week-long process that we take that through. There's a variety of tests that are run on it, pre-production things. But we have that extra week beyond the sprint, if you will. Now, the team isn't super involved in that 4th week. The operations team is, who's doing the deployments, and members of the team if we find critical bugs that we need to fix. But for the most part, the team has moved on. So let me explain this a little bit more. The beginning of the sprint, day 1 is sprint planning. It's traditional Scrum, what you'd expect. At the end of week 3, we're done, and we really are done. Code's checked in, it's tested, bugs are fixed, we're feeling good. And then at the end of the 4th week, we do that deployment. Okay, so we let it all sit together for a week, and then we do a deployment. Now, I want to talk about a couple practices that we do in between here. In the middle of week 2, we do what's called backlog grooming. And I think Jez was talking yesterday about, you know, what he didn't like about Scrum was that the product owner is always right, right? I couldn't agree more. Don't let that be the pattern on your teams. Your teams have to have a say in what they're building. And they better have a say. It's not just the product owner's decision. And so I couldn't agree with that statement more. And one of the things that we've done is halfway through the sprint, we'll have a backlog grooming session where the product owner brings what's coming up for the next sprint. And, you know, If you show up to sprint planning on Monday morning and you're surprised about what's in the plan for the next sprint, your team has failed, your product owner's failed, you're not doing it right. So you got to have this transparency and communication. It's not like it's a secret every sprint about what we're going to build next. The team knows. And the team is actually working with the product owner to queue these things up and line up a plan that makes the most sense. So there's a lot of interaction there. But at the end of week three, the team starts. So this week four is kind of this overlap here where you've got the team actually starting on the next sprint, but the bits that we finished before are moving through to deployment. And the process repeats itself. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the sprint mechanics. What does that look like? Brian mentioned this a little bit in his talk, but I want to show you a little bit about it. We do these sprint mails. So it's kind of a pattern that we've picked up. At the beginning of every sprint, after sprint planning meetings, every team sends out a mail. Here's our plan for the sprint. Here's the stories we're tackling. Here's what we're going to do. They send it out to the entire group. All 400 people see these. At the end of the sprint, the team reports back on what it accomplished. Okay? Here's what we got done. And they usually include a video of some sort to highlight some of the new value they've added. This has been something that's been a lot of fun. It's a trap, though. I'm going to warn you. Be careful if you try to adopt this practice. You'll find that your PMs and your team members start spending all day Friday producing these really crazy videos. I have seen some really well-produced, cinema-quality sprint videos. And that's not the point, okay? It's not to show off your movie maker skills or how great you are in Camtasia. It's just to communicate the value. And when you've got, whether it's 10 teams or 20 teams or even 3 teams, you want to find a way that the team can celebrate what they accomplished and share it with the rest of the group. And we found that this works really well. So here's a little bit, kind of gives you an idea of the goals. Actually, I grayed something out earlier because it's something coming up. I thought I might get in trouble if I shared it with you. So this is from a recent sprint. And then at the end, here's some of the things that we completed. And you notice like this number 2, I can mention a work item as a part of a Git commit. This was stuff that was finished just, 4 weeks ago or something in preparation for yesterday's announcement. But you can see it's marked as complete, but they're also very transparent. We've got some ongoing. We found some additional work here that we're going to keep working on. And we're pulling that into our next sprint. So there's a really rich, transparent communication going on here in these mails. And then, of course, the sprint demos. Now, how do you do this at scale? This can turn into a lot of email, right? And that email can start to clog people's inbox and you feel like spam almost. I say let it happen. I don't care. I'd rather err on the side of transparency than start hiding this stuff and creating some elaborate process to roll it all up that takes time and whatnot. Let the team itself communicate directly with the rest of the organization. It's important. So how do we do it at scale? I'm going to show you. We talked about control and environment. We're trying to create a place where we've got high visibility and where we can make good decisions. I talked a little bit about that earlier. So what we've found is that we take that sprint cadence every 3 weeks, and if you kind of expand this out, we've created something that we call team chats. And every other sprint, so every 6 weeks, every team comes in and sits down with leadership to talk about what they've been doing. They don't really talk about what they've done because that's been communicated in the mails, but what they're going to do is they're going to highlight 3 things. What's next? Give me a view into your backlog. The next 2 to 3 sprints, what does that look like? What are you guys thinking is coming next, and how are you going to do it? How's the team doing? Just tell me how you're doing. Be honest. Is somebody having a problem? Are you guys feeling good? Are you feeling behind? Are you feeling ahead? How you feeling? And just are there any issues? And it's a very, very transparent conversation. Now, that conversation happens between the team members and leadership, okay? It's a direct conversation between the team members and leadership. I want to highlight that. So I'll give you an example. I have PMs that work for me that are on these teams. I report to Lori Lampkin, who's our director of PM, and Lori reports to Brian, okay? Every 6 weeks, we have a 4-hour meeting that Brian and Lori and Buck, our director of development, and Munil, our director of test, they sit down in a room for a long period of time, and the teams come in for a 15 to 20 minute slot to talk about these things. It's not me, it's not Lori or somebody else taking that message to leadership. It's direct. And I love this because It's not a conversation that I have to pass on up the chain, but it's a conversation that the team has to have directly with those at the top. And I think this is really important. We talked again about autonomy, mastery, and purpose and that environment. This is how people feel like they have a stake in the game, right? They get a direct conversation. You're going to hear what Brian and others think about what your plan, and you're going to get some really direct feedback. Now, many people have organizations that look like this, where you have an org chart with many, many levels. And what usually happens is we see this diluted message from the team, you know, moving through this chain of command, if you will, and it finally makes it up to the top. And I just think that's unhealthy. So I would encourage you and your own teams to make sure that you have a place where you can have these direct and honest conversations with leadership, and let your teams do that. I think it's great for leadership to hear directly from them, and it's great for your teams as well. Okay. Our plan. How do we think about plans? I think one of the biggest myths in Agile is, and I think it's actually gone away. I think people finally get it. But you used to hear a lot that, you know, Agile teams don't do plan. They're just cowboy coders doing what they want. Agile teams are the best planners. They plan really, really well, because they're planning constantly and learning constantly and planning constantly and learning constantly. That's just what they do. And it's a part of what makes them good. So I'm going to show you how we do this. I'm not here to tell you it's perfect or good, but it's worked well for us. We divide our year into six-month seasons. It sounds kind of odd, but we have spring and fall. So spring started January 1st and runs through the end of June, and that's what we call spring. So we're in the middle of spring right now. I know, it's winter, but just bear with me. And then fall runs from July 1st, the middle of summer, to the end of the year. So we have these two kind of seasons, six-month cycles. And we always try to have an 18-month vision of where we want to go in the next 18 months. And that vision looks like usually a set of storyboards that PMs and leadership and others have worked together on to say, here's where we want to go. So, you know, if we took, for example, the Git stuff, I can remember being in North Carolina a year ago and talking about Git with PMs and leadership and what we were going to do. And that was a part, it was built into our 18-month vision. We wanted to embrace Git. And you saw that happen yesterday with the announcement. But it's always out there. It's what we do. Then we go back to those six-month seasons, if you will, and we build a more concrete vision for what we want to do for the next 6 months. Now, it doesn't mean that we complete everything in that 6 months, and we're wrong. We actually went through a period in the fall where we had a vision for what we wanted to do in the second half of 2012. And we didn't get as much done as we wanted to. But we had that vision, and that's what we are driving for. And that vision is circulated to everyone. Everyone on the team knows what we're doing and what the goals are for that spring. And so you can imagine is every 6 months you're revisiting this thing and putting together that new vision, that new set of storyboards. And this 18-month vision is almost added to or modified every 6 months. So it's always there. And we keep that as our guiding star. That's our big picture plan, if you will. Now the teams then take that and break them down into a set of stories, experiences, and that becomes their backlogs. And then they have autonomy to manage their backlogs. And during those team chats, we're checking in. How are you guys doing on this? How are you feeling on that? Are we going to make it by the end of, you know, this season with some of the goals that we set out? So that's how we do it. What does that actual work look like? We have four levels in our work item database. We have user stories and tasks at the bottom level, so probably just like many of you. User stories and tasks, and we have two levels above that. The first level above is called an experience, which is an end-to-end set of user stories. And then beyond that is something called the scenario. So I'll give you an example. In TFS 2012, I was a scenario owner for one of the 100 or so scenarios across the entire division. In TFS, we only had four, but I owned one of them, and it was called Agile Project Management. And then we had a set of experiences that went with that, which were, you know, I can manage my backlog. I can plan a sprint. I can use a task board to manage the day-to-day. I can view a burndown chart. And then those experiences were broken down to a set of stories. I can drag and drop something on my backlog. I can create a forecast from my backlog. I can quickly, you know, view the plan for my sprint. And then those stories are broken down into tasks. So it's pretty traditional, traditional Agile, if you will. This is kind of a glance at what those things look like. So here's that Agile project management. Here's a Kanban board customizable columns. This is an experience that we just showed you guys yesterday for the first time. Here's a sample user story, and then here's a sample task. We actually just went through a process at the beginning of this release to drastically reduce the number of fields on our work item forms. If you've been in any of my talks, you've heard me talk about this before, that we've had a problem with this. We had a lot of process creep in our work item forms, and our bug form is the biggest one where we had process creep. And I'm happy to show you that our bug form has been cleaned up. I think that I didn't count these, but last year I think I reported there was like 156 fields on our bug form, which was just ridiculous. I think we've got it down to about half that, but there are still three tabs, so there's a lot going on here. There's a lot of different fields. But the idea is that you want to have a simple process, a simple set of fields that your team understands, because these work item forms, for them, I think they're really for the team. I think management, leadership are going to get some value out of that, but first and foremost, they're for the team. And you want to make sure that you've got the right vehicle for your team to drive here. You know, I tell a story often is that you're trying to get to the end of the block to 7-Eleven. There's a lot of different options. You can take a skateboard. You can drive a car. You can ride the space shuttle. And don't build space shuttles into your process when you're just trying to get from point A to point B. They often don't need to be that complex. Okay, so what about methodology? What are we? I don't know. At the lowest level, we're a Scrum team. We look the most like a Scrum team. There are some elements of waterfall in our process, and I'm not afraid to admit it. I'm just not. We're adopting Kanban. I think looking at flow across long periods of time and seeing the value move from left to right across our boards is becoming something that's been very powerful. We've got a lot of sort of Microsoft process and methodology just kind of built into us over years that is there. And then the build, measure, learn thing is something with our service that we're really starting to adopt. So I don't know what you'd call us, but that's kind of what we are. And I want to show you some examples. Here's some rules that we follow, I think, from different methodologies. So we do big picture planning. I showed you our 18-month vision. We do design work. We do that, and we write specs. We have sprint planning meetings like Scrum teams. We do daily stand-up. We have cross-functional teams, and all of our teams do retrospectives. And then we're very into the visual tracking, and we're learning how to do WIP limits as well. So that's some practices and some rules that we follow. Now, next slide. Here's rules we break. And I'm not afraid to admit that we break some rules as well. We change our minds a lot. And that's because the opportunities are changing a lot. And the landscape is changing a lot. And we need to change our minds a lot. So I don't care. We're going to change our minds a lot because we're learning. We're learning from what we're building. We're learning from customers like yourselves, from what you're teaching us. And if we're not changing our minds, we're not doing our jobs. So we don't do this willy-nilly, but we do it. Rules we break, design and specs. If I pulled up a spec, I don't have time to show you a spec today, but if I pulled up a spec from one of our teams, you would see that it's not a 45-page Word doc. It's most likely a PowerPoint presentation. And that's because it's got some pictures in it, it's got some visuals, it's got some lightweight design in it, but it's not a 50-page spec with every field and every type documented forever. You know, it's just not. We've broken away from that, and we've found that we can write lightweight specs and give them to our teams and see a lot of value come out the other end, and it's working for us. Now, I'm not saying that can work for every team, but it's working for us, and it's what we've done. We don't have formal sprint reviews, so at the end of sprints, teams hold sprint reviews, but we've adopted the practice of send a mail out and get a video out. We do a lot of that. We do a rotating Scrum Master. I love this one. I go to a lot of organizations where they say, you know, what's your role? And they go, I'm the Scrum Master. And I'm like, really? Like, what do you do all day? you go to stand up and, you know, facilitate that for 15 minutes, and then what? Self-managing teams should be self-managing. And we find different people to play the Scrum Master role every single sprint. And we rotate it. So we want you know, the guy who joined the team 4 months ago, I want him to play scrum master one role. I want him to run stand up and make sure the team's doing all the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's. And it's a part of building a self-managed team. Our program managers, remember, I'm a program manager. We have one of those per team. Our program managers are never the scrum master. We do that by design, because what it turns our program manager into is a project manager. And we don't want that. So our program managers are product owners. They own the backlog. They're going to participate in team meetings, in stand-up, but I'm not going to let them be the scrum master, because I don't want them to turn that into a project management role. We track bugs. We have some pretty specific bug metrics that we pay attention to. It's a part of that Microsoft culture that I talked about, but it's how we pay attention to how a team is doing in terms of its debt. We have a bug cap right now that we call it, and when a team gets more than three bugs per engineer on the team, so you got a team of, let's say, 10 people, and they exceed 3 bugs per person, 30 bugs, they go into kind of like a bug jail. And we want them to get that debt down before they start on new work. And that's something that we track. I know it's not perfect by methodology standards. I'm not claiming it is, but it's worked for us, and it's something that we've adopted. And then we deploy 1 week after the sprint. I talked about WIP limits, iterations and schedule. We do that stuff, so that's not pure Kanban. So the very, very basics. Our teams are made up of about 8 to 12 folks. They're cross-discipline. We do 3-week sprints. We do 6-week leadership reviews, what we call team chats, 6-month planning cycles, and 18-month vision. What we're trying to do here is create an environment where our teams can be efficient, be fast, and be super effective and produce the most value. Again, I'm not saying it's perfect, but it's what's worked for us, and we've found a lot of value in it. So, okay, I've only got a few minutes left, and I'm just going to show you guys some really quick stuff. I wanted to highlight two features that I think we've done recently. Hold on one second, sorry. That are really helping in this regard. And I don't mean this just to sort of pimp TFS, but I want to show it to you. The first one is work item tags. Work item tags are this great new way that you can mark up work items, and your teams can mark up work items to put the metadata that they need on them. Let your teams do this. When we were talking with our MVPs about this feature, the first thing they wanted were permissions. I want to lock down who can add tags. And it's a great feature. Don't worry. We're going to add it. But I also fought back, and I said, don't turn tags into something that people have to ask permission to do. The reason we added them is so that your team can go add what they need to their work items, not necessarily what you need. You own the process template. You get to do all that. Let tags be something they get to use. So that's the first thing. The second thing is our customizable columns. And, you know, I've got a sort of sample scenario here where I've got two teams, and one of these teams is actually a Scrum team. So they're working in iterations, all in the same project. And you can see that I've got my backlog here, and I've got my sprints, and I've got a board. And I'm able to customize these columns as a team member and create the columns that make sense for our grooming process and my backlog process. But what I can do is I can map those columns to different states, and I can create my set of WIP limits. Now, I've got another team in here called ALM Demo Rentals. And you can see this team has a board, but they don't have sprints. They're sort of a more traditional pure Kanban team. They're not working in iterations. They're just using limits to manage how much work they've got going. And they've customized their set of columns to match their process. Now, what's great about this is I can actually create queries then at any level that then show me the progress of both of these teams. So you've got a Kanban team here, and you've got a Scrum team existing together inside the same team project. And I'll show you that by showing you the different area path. And I can use state to say, hey, I want to manage and make sure I pay attention to when work is in progress. And I can do that by using state. But I can let the team take the column aspect and do whatever they want with it. And I hope when you guys get your hands on this feature, you let your teams do that. Don't dictate what columns are on their Kanban boards. Let them choose the columns they need, because they need the autonomy to build the fastest pipe, if you will, through that sprint or through that iteration. Okay, so those were two kind of really quick features. No, I do not want to install Office updates right now. So in summary, I want to leave you with four things. First is build an environment where your teams will thrive. Get the process out of their way. Don't let the process inhibit your teams from producing value. Just don't let it. Pay attention to that. You heard me pimp Dan Pink's book, Drive, Motivation, Autonomy, Mastery, and Purpose. Think about these things. Read his book and just think about them in the context of your teams. I think you'll get a lot out of it. Grab a board game when you get home, play it, and remember that you've got object, rules, and the score. Make sure your teams understand this. What's the object? What are the boundaries that they can work in? And how are you going to keep score? And make sure you're in agreement on that. If you're keeping score differently, it's going to be a problem. And then finally, break away from some of the religious dogma. Are you following a process because you think it's right, or you read it's right in a book? Or are you doing what makes sense in your organization? And again, I'm a strong believer in square pegs, round holes, and they're not all going to fit together. So don't take what you learned here and think that you can blindly apply it to your org and it's going to be successful. Go back and think about it. Talk to the members of your team. Talk to leadership. And find that right balance so that you can have really, really healthy environments for your team. We're out of time, so thank you very much.